ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
His is the voice that has brought us our biggest sporting moments. From Cathy Freeman winning the 400 metres at the Sydney Olympics to last year's Women's World Cup, along with the Australian Open, 20 AFL Grand Finals and multiple Melbourne Cups. Bruce McAvaney is quite simply the voice of Australian sport, with a commentating style built on a relentless work ethic and encyclopedic knowledge, and powered by genuine passion and heartfelt sincerity. Bruce's love of sport began with horse racing when he was just a little kid. But if he hadn't chucked a sickie one day while working as a public servant, the past 50 years of Australian sport might have sounded very different. Hi, Bruce.
Sarah, lovely to chat to you. I've listened to you and Richard over the years and thought, boy, that's an interesting subject they've got on today.
We mightn't move as fast as some of the content you're usually listening to or watching, Bruce, but we'll see if we can get a goal today anyway. You began race calling very young, in your family lounge room, in fact. Tell me how that happened.
From about four or five, Sarah, so I had this, I guess, desire, this dream that I wanted to call a Melbourne Cup from a very young age. Mum and Dad loved sport. They took me to the races and the harness racing, or the trots as we knew it in those days. And I listened to a race caller in Melbourne called Bill Collins. I lived in Adelaide and we used to get his calls. And I thought, gee, he was just the best. And I thought, that's who I want to be. I want to be him and I want to do what he does. So how do you go about doing these things when you know, phantom calls when you're very young? So when we'd go to those race meetings, I'd come home with the bookmaker's cardboard names of the horses and, you know, collect a dozen of them or whatever. And I'd put them on the carpet in the lounge room and line them up, push them around in a circle and go my hardest. So look, Mum and Dad, they must have thought, boy, we've got a weird one here. But they listened. And so I practiced from a very early age. And I guess in many ways I based my style on the way that Bill did it. And he was a very emotive caller, a guy that, you know, at the end of a race could make you sort of feel great, even if you didn't pick the winner. He was very accurate and he had a way that I tried to copy. So, yeah, from that very, very early stage.
It's interesting that as a little boy you weren't dreaming of being a jockey, you weren't dreaming of riding the winning horse, but you were dreaming of calling the race.
It's strange, isn't it? Because, look, I had three things, I guess, Sarah, that I wanted to do when I was young. The main one was to be a race caller and call the biggest race in Australia. The other two were to be a very good footballer. This is Australian rules, living in Adelaide, and play what we called SNFL, league football in Adelaide, and the other one was to play test cricket. So they were the three things, but the racing calling was always the priority, was the number one, and the other two, well, they would perhaps be a little more daunting and perhaps a little more difficult to achieve. But one out of three, eh? Not quite meatloaf, but I was on the way.
You even wrote a letter to this race caller that you admired, Bill Collins. How did that play out?
Well, Mum helped me. I was about 11 and I can remember the first few words, "Dear Mr. Collins, I want to be a race caller." And then after that, Mum probably took over and helped me write it. And he wrote back and said, the one thing I probably didn't want him to say, Sarah, was get a good education because I wasn't quite as keen on school as I was on other things. But, yeah, so, wow, he's taken my letter and got back to me. And then at 11 years of age, I felt like, wow, the world's at my feet.
So your family obviously had a love of sport and a love of horse racing in particular. Did it mean betting on the horses at your place? Did they go hand in hand, watching the races, listening to the races and betting on them?
They did. Mum and Dad were small punters, but they loved a bet. They were typical of their, I guess, generation. They were born in the 1920s and went through that depression and through World War II and came out the other side. So, yeah, they'd love a bet. And Dad in those days, on a Saturday morning, would walk from our house around the corner to the phone box and ring a gentleman who was taking a bet which was illegal, which is, you know, I guess retrospectively I'm safe, but it was called SP betting because the totalisator hadn't even started when we started the bet. You had to go to the races to have a bet and we couldn't go every week. So that's the way we'd do it. And I'd put my 2 and sixpence, 25 cents on a horse for a place that was the favourite, and we went from there. So the gambling bit was certainly a part of it, that's for sure.
What happened when the horses came in for your mum one night, actually at the races, whether you remember?
So this was an amazing story, and it's still very vivid. So what year are we talking? Probably about 1963 or 1964, so it's a long, long time ago. It's 60 years ago. But we went to Wavell, which was this little trotting track near the heart of Adelaide, and in the very first race, Mum took a Cornella 4 and 11, Fiery Demon and Charney Boy were the horses. There was a favourite in the race that Dad backed and we all thought would win, and he stumbled at the start and took no part really. So Mum collected £89.96 from the very first race at Wavell. Now, I think she was the only successful person who took the Quinella. Sarah, she sat in the grandstand for the rest of the night with her purse absolutely shut with this £89.96. She didn't move for the rest of the night. So
what, she was worried that something would happen to it?
I think she was worried she'd either put a hand in there and waste some of the £89.96, or somebody might grab her purse. I'm not sure why. She was just so excited. It was a lot of money. And I know that, you know, we didn't have a washing machine at that stage, and we didn't have a lot. We came from a pretty poor background, as it turned out. And for Mum, it was a huge, huge thing. And I remember when we came home, we had these great friends across the road, the Walshes, and their son Charlie went on to be the coach of the Australian cycling team at the Olympic Games, and a very, very successful person, Charlie Walsh. His mother and father came over that night. It must have been about 11 o'clock. We all had ice cream, and honestly, it was one of the great nights in the McAvaney household of all time. So I can remember it like it was yesterday.
And how delightful, if money was a bit tight at home, just to have that chance to have something fun with it, to spend it on something frivolous or unnecessary like ice cream.
Exactly, but I think she might have bought the washing machine as well.
Right. So
that certainly, Mum did put it to a good cause in the end, but the ice cream, nothing better than that on a hot summer's night.
Honestly, a mother with young kids, the washing machine might have been the greatest prize you could have acquired at that point too. Tell me more about the house that you grew up in, Bruce. What did it look like?
So we were in what they called a trust home. So Mum and Dad must have gone in there, I think, just before I was born in 1953. Inverway Street, Ferreton Park, tiny house, 3 bedrooms, but really small home with a little bit of a lounge room where the TV was, and a kitchen, and, you know, a toilet, laundry and bathroom. They were all tiny. So small house, huge backyard and big front yard. So that was sort of the formula in the 1950s in Australia. So you could kick a footy and hit a cricket ball and maybe play tennis up against the wall, but not much room inside the house, but plenty of room outside the house. And it was a good way to grow up in many ways. But, you know, I shared a bedroom with my brother. It was tight. We had a fantastic street, never locked our doors, knew all the neighbours. We'd sleep outside when it was hot, didn't have air conditioning. It was a different world.
What did your mum and dad do for work?
Both left school at 13. I'm going to look back on it. It's quite remarkable, isn't it? So they left school at 13. Dad went into the PMG and was a telegraph messenger for a while. So and then he ended up going into the army in World War II and went to New Guinea as a signalman, a Morse code, etc. So Dad was over there for about a year and a half. And then after World War II, when Dad came home, a very big part of our life was that my father went back to study and did his accountancy, and he spent a lot of hours on our kitchen table where we all had to be pretty quiet while he was studying, and Dad ended up being an investigations officer in the taxation department. Mum, she always said that there was the saddest day of her life when she left school at 13. She both loved education. And Mum, once we were a little bit older, did various jobs as secretary of work and in a petrol station, and then went to work for the Advertiser for News Limited for a while. So, yeah, that in a nutshell is what they did.
And so sport in their week would have been partly a reward for a week of hard work, the entertainment you get at the end of the week.
Absolutely. And they were both keen sports people. Dad wasn't a great footballer or cricketer, but he was keen, and he ended up being a league goal umpire for a while, much to, I guess, our embarrassment as little kids, because you don't want your dad being a goal umpire that wears glasses. So anyway, that again, a lot of stories there if I wanted to. Mum was a very good what we call netballer. It was basketball in those days that they called it. And Mum was at a high level, and her sister, Auntie Peggy, ended up playing for Australia as the goal attack. She went to England with the Australian team. So that was a big part of our life, Aunty Peggy, the fact that she played for Australia in that what we know as netball now. So, yeah, they were keen sports people.
So your mum having to leave school at 13 and your dad going back as an adult to get his qualifications, I guess they placed a lot of value on education when it came to their kids. Did you live up to those aspirations of theirs when you were at school, Bruce?
Sarah, some years I did and most years I didn't. When I look back now, I'm very disappointed and a little ashamed that I didn't take advantage of the opportunity I was given. But I would fluctuate from being one of the best behaved and best performed students in one year to somebody who was out of the class more than they were in the class. So it was a strange thing when
Why
I look
was
back.
That, and do you think? Was it whether you were interested in the subject itself or what was that about?
I think it was a connection with the teacher as much as anything. There were some subjects that I loved, history and English particularly, and others I was intimidated by. The sciences I really struggled with. But I think if a teacher, I clicked with a certain teacher, then I would live for that teacher and had that relationship. I followed my sister, who was the brightest girl at Ferrin Park Primary and then sort of ducks of the school at Woodville High, and she was a hard act to follow because every teacher would compare me with her, Sarah, and it was pretty hard to live up to that, and I was never quite going to manage that. So, look, I'm throwing out a lot of excuses for what happened.
You've made up for it, Bruce. I don't think you should carry that burden too heavily. Were you a rebellious teenager? Like, were there parties? Was there bands? What else was happening for you as an adolescent?
I was always respectful to mum and dad, but I certainly had my wild side. And, you know, they were those parties and all the things that young teenagers do and you know, alcohol becomes available and you start to drive a motor car and all the things and you're more independent than you were in the past. So I went through that normal, I guess, 15 to 20. When I look back and think about it, so unfortunately, I was probably a teenager longer than most, probably well into my mid-30s at times. It's taken me a long time to grow up in many ways, but I'm getting there.
So you had these dreams of sport from such an early age, but what happened work-wise for you straight after school?
So I went to the public service, Department of Supply for a short time, and then
does that still exist? What even is the Department of Supply?
I don't think it does anymore. It was part of the weapons research establishment, and we would tender and buy weapons, etc. Now I certainly
and what
wasn't
was your,
at that level.
Yeah, what was your role in that?
No, my role was the first job I had was to pick up a big suitcase and walk down King William Street in Adelaide and go to the post office and collect the mail, bring it all back and then distribute it. They say I was the slowest mail boy of all time because I used to take my time going down and take my time coming back and chat to a few people along the way. So that was my first job. And then after that, I went into what used to be the Postmaster General's department. It was telecom and I worked as a clerk there. So that's what I was working at. And that dream of still being a race caller, it wasn't a dream to be in the media. It was a dream to call races specifically. It had dimmed, Sarah. It wasn't quite as strong because I really felt like it wasn't going to happen. How I coped with that and thought about it, I guess it's matter of fact, you get on with it. It would have been a huge disappointment for me, I know, but I didn't think I'd get that opportunity. And then one fateful day, something happened.
On this fateful day, you'd taken a day off work to go and see a horse race. What horse race?
It was the Kilmore Cup, which was a pacing race, part of trotting in Victoria. So, God, I look back and think, why did I do these things? But it wasn't the only day I took off to go to the races when I was at work. So I flew to Kilmore and sitting alongside me was a friend of mine, someone I knew pretty well at the time, Kevin Hillier, and got to know a lot better. And he and I chatted and I spoke to him about how I wanted to be a caller and he half knew that. But so one of the things he did was he would call the trotting trials at Globe Derby Park in Adelaide on a Sunday morning and Wednesday night. And he said to me on this trip, come on, I need a bit of help. Come out and help me. And I said, okay, I might do that. It took him about 3 months to convince me to come out there. So I'd go out there on a Sunday.
Given that you knew you wanted to, what was stopping you?
I didn't think I was up to it. So one of the things I think most people would say, how difficult it was talking in front of a classroom. And I found that extremely difficult, and yet I was a chatterbox. So when the spotlight was on me, I could wither and be intimidated. So I just didn't know whether I was going to be, A, good enough. I didn't want to know that I wasn't good enough, a bit of the old Zilda Fitzgerald, I guess. You know, does anyone really want to know what their limitations are? So I, in the end, he talked me into it. I went out there, and then all these lucky things happened. So within about 3 or 4 months of that, Kevin was asked by the radio station in Adelaide whether he would call the Oakbank races. Now, this is a race meeting that's iconic in South Australia. It's in the Adelaide Hills. It happens at Easter time on the Saturday and the Monday. And when I was starting off, they used to get 50 or 60,000 people on the Saturday and 70,000 on the Monday. It's quite incredible. So one of the callers had gone on annual leave. How they let them do that, I don't know. So he said, look, I've got this young fella. Why don't you give him a chance? So they auditioned me at the Gawler trotting track, where I had to stand with a tape recorder with the boss of the radio station standing alongside me with in the middle of the crowd, and I was absolutely petrified. So how I got through that, I'm not sure. And then they said, yep, you can go to Oakbank and do it. So it was an incredible time. I couldn't sleep the night before, and my mother and father were very excited, and off I went.
And off you went. What sort of preparation did you do before that first big race?
Well, it sort of set me up in a way. So I thought, how am I going to learn these colours? Because I didn't know all the colours that I thought. So I wrote down the names of the horses, every horse in the race, and I got the coloured pencils out and painted the colours alongside of them. And I memorised those in the last 2 or 3 days before the meeting, took those papers with me, had them in my head, and that was the way I learnt on that fateful day. And Sarah, it was really the beginning of, I guess, learning how to prepare for what was to follow. So when I look back, I only called a very short part of these races, about 400 metres. There was no television. No one could see what I was calling. I could have made it up. Now, I didn't make it up. I'm sure I made plenty of mistakes, but those two meetings set me up with that radio station. They offered me a situation where they'd give me $20 if I'd call one race on a Tuesday night and one race on a Saturday night. They put me on a retainer. I still worked at the public service. And then about 5 months later, one of their race callers got a job offer. He went to Melbourne. There was a job vacancy, and they asked me whether I wanted to go full-time.
What do your mum and dad think about you taking the leap from the very safe public service to the world of race calling?
It was interesting. Mum just about pushed me out the door, and Dad said, oh, I wouldn't give up that public service, Bruce. Still do it part-time. They came through the Depression. It was, I guess it was that era, that generation that knew that job security was so important. Life's changed so much, Sarah. I mean, we've got two children now, and they're young adults between 20 and 30 now, probably try 4, 5, 6 different jobs. In our day, in my day, you didn't do that. So it was a big thing. So Mum said, yep. Dad said, ooh. So got the nod, and was always going to get the nod.
I've seen a photo of you back in the 70s, Bruce, where you've got your binoculars on a stick. Was that a common thing? Is that how callers would set up? Maybe they still do.
They still do, Sarah. So to call a horse race, the horses are a long way away from you. So you need steady hands, and you need those big binoculars not to be shaking in your hand. So yeah, we'd have a stand for them, you know, headphones on like you've got today and I've got today, and hold those binoculars and use those so that you could identify the horses.
And did it change the way you looked at a race? I mean, you'd been kind of pretending to call races from a little kid, but once you were doing it professionally or with that role, did you start seeing the race differently?
It's a good question. It felt natural that all that, I guess, preparation I'd done without really knowing I'd be able to use it came into good stead. So the rhythm of a race call, I sort of had instinctively because I'd practiced as a young boy, but the identification was the trick. I mean, you think about a Melbourne Cup, the horses get so far away from you. There are 24 horses, and there's a point in the Melbourne Cup between the 1,200 metres and the 450 on the home turn where they're all making their runs and they're 3, 4, 5 wide and they're jagged in between one another. So that's the trick, identification, to pick those colours up very quickly and to hold your nerve and hold those binoculars steady. And I found it a challenge, but a challenge I could not master. I don't think anyone masters anything, to be honest, but it's something I could do at a good level.
Where were you getting your knowledge, Bruce? You know, all of us now, I think most of us now, head to the internet when we need to at least pretend mastery over some subject. Where were you getting the detailed knowledge you needed to do that job well?
At the track, really. Going to those trotting trials, going to the races, seeing it live, talking to people, getting to know them, you know, getting to know the journalists, getting to know the trainers and the owners and in horse racing terms, the jockeys. And so it was really first-hand knowledge, which I loved. And as you say, we just did not have the information we have these days. I would keep cards. So in trotting in particular, I would set up a horse. I'd write its name on a cardboard, you know, sort of cut-out card, and I would write down every run that it had. So I did that with footballers as well. So that's the way I would keep abreast of a horse's career or a footballer's progress or non-progress in a season. So it was a lot of work, but I always found the preparation, even in those days, really interesting, but also realised at an early age that the more you knew about something, the more fascinating it became.
Calling the Melbourne Cup had been your dream right from the earliest days. Tell me about that first time. Was it something that you knew well in advance was going to be in the offering for you?
About 6 months out, I was asked whether I would step up. I was working at Channel 10 in Melbourne. I'd gone over there really for the Olympic Games in 1984. So this Melbourne Cup we're talking about is in 1985. So I knew for quite a while and said, I was just so nervous. Honestly, I'm not exaggerating. I would have thought about it every day and I would have had a lot of sleepless nights because I realised the enormity of it. But also probably realised this is the dream coming true. And sometimes that can be quite stark when it happens. So the build-up for me personally was fairly intense. And then it was a big event, it was the first time the race was worth $1 million, so big prize money increase. The guests of honour at the track were Charles and Diana, so, you know, massive occasion. and off I went on the day and was just, honestly, that morning just thinking, gee, I wish it was Wednesday morning and not the first Tuesday in November, but Wednesday, because I knew then I would know my fate, because you do walk a tightrope. The cup itself, it's an hour between races 6 and 7. The horses come into the mounting yard. It all builds up. You're learning those colours. You're doing everything you can. You've done all your homework. Off they go to the barrier. And just to break it down, sir, the first part of the race, they run straight at you from up the straight, but it's not difficult. They're sorting themselves out and they go out of the straight and they run along the riverside and they're not very far from you. So you're getting into a bit of a rhythm and you're settling down a bit. But then from about that 1,200, 1,400 metre mark, which the old Chiquita Lodge, where some famous stables were in the old days, that's where the race takes shape. That's where the horses that are in front may be tiring. Those that are at the back need to be pressing forward. The favourites need to be getting going. And that's when it all changes from about the 1,400 to the home turn. And then on the home turn, they're across the track about 10 wide and you're looking, trying to see the horses that have got momentum. And then with about 200 metres to go, you drop your eyes from the binoculars and then you focus in and then you just hope you get it right. Well, in this case, a horse called What a Nuisance got through on the inside, trained by Johnny Marr, ridden by Pat Hyland, came through to win that Melbourne Cup. So, oh boy.
I feel like I was there, Bruce. That was wonderful. I feel like you just called the 1985 race again.
it was a great relief at the end of it, I can tell you.
Right from the early days, as you describe it, growing up, horse racing and betting on the horses were intertwined for you and your family. Is that still the case? Do you still bet on the races?
Really? I've got tiny interest in horses, you know, in ownership. So when they run, I always put something on, certainly Melbourne Cup time. But Sarah, no, it's become certainly less for me. I certainly was betting far too much for, A, what I was earning and what was, I think, healthy. For a lot of my, late teens through my 20s and probably well into my 30s, but it was a case of, okay, how do I get my head around still enjoying it, but lessening the amount of times that I bet and also the amount of money I bet? And I did that. I was able to do that to the point where it was completely under control and I was still gambling less than I was, but on a regular basis, but with far less impact on our lives or effect on our lives if we weren't winning. And I'm talking about my wife, Annie, now. And so I was able to do it over a period of time and to a point now where it's a very small part of why I enjoy horse racing.
What do you love about horse racing then? What's the heart of it?
The thoroughbred itself, the animal itself, the most noble creatures and their absolute personalities and they're beautiful beasts, they are. It's an intriguing sport with many, many levels. It's a huge, huge part of Australia's history. I love the sport. I'll always love the sport and it's always going to be a big part of my life.
Podcast, broadcast, conversations with Sarah Konoski.
Bruce, you say that when you made that decision back in the late 70s to quit your job in the public service and take the leap into sports broadcasting, your father was worried. How did he know in 1984 that your dad had come round to this choice of yours?
Well, he was always a huge supporter of mine. I mean, he was the one that taught me to kick a footy and play cricket and all those things, and we were very close. So, yeah, that was... My father retired in about March 1984. He was only 50. He would have been just turning 59 because I was calling the Olympics in Los Angeles and he wanted to stay home. Unlike his son, he didn't take sickies and he wanted to stay home and watch those Olympic games with my mum. So it was, I guess, Sarah, there was a period where a lot of men and women were retiring in their late 50s. Things are changing for many of us now, but it was a big thing. And for my father to do that, it was, I felt like it was him saying to me, I'm very proud of you. But I didn't really need that because mum and dad always gave me that feeling that they had my back, they loved me unconditionally, and they were supporting me. But, yeah, so that's what my father did in 1984.
And what about you, Bruce? What do you remember about heading to LA for your first in-person Olympics?
Excitement. Not knowing what was happening, really. Just ready for take on anything, Sarah. But nervous, obviously, because you are. And I'm always nervous. I'm always anxious before. I'm probably at my least anxious when the headphones are on. But I fell in love with the Olympics from a pretty young age. And our Australian history and those great champions like Betty Cuthbert and Marjorie Jackson and Dawn Fraser and Herb Elliott when I was growing up as a young boy. So to go to Los Angeles in 84 was just one of the great highlights of my life. Did not disappoint.
How different is it calling human athletes as opposed to horses?
It is. And within human athletes, it's different as well because of the event. But the principles are similar because you look for the favourites. You look for those that come from the back and those that are leaders. But when you think about the Olympic Games and calling track and field, you're calling races that take 10 seconds, 100 metres, and calling a race that takes 2 hours and 10 minutes, the marathon. And in between, there's hurdle races, steeplechases, various sprints, whatever. So it really does give you the ultimate test in so many ways because you've got to be able to call quickly and accurately. But at the same time, then tell a story, weave a narrative through a marathon because you're not calling that. You're talking that and you're bringing in stories and bits and pieces about the athletes who will make the listener or the viewer interested in that person. 100-metre final, you're just hanging on by the seat of your pants and hoping like crazy you get it right.
And I'm assuming, Bruce, that you had a whole lot of folders and exercise books highlighted with you as you went into the commentary box for those Olympics.
You're right. I did and I still do because, again, it's, I guess, relieved some of the pressure for me. one thing I think I fear more than anything is failing in a broadcasting sense. And none of us, you know, I have calls that I'd love to take back, but I would feel worse if I felt like I hadn't given myself every possibility, every chance to perform. And that's been my, I guess, mantra, the way I've gone about it. Even if you can't always call at the highest level, give yourself that opportunity.
I guess that preparation also highlights some of the stories that mightn't be obvious just by watching the race or the event itself, where there you get, yes, the winner, but there are all those other stories that come to the surface, particularly at an event like the Olympics, that can end up being the most affecting or moving for people.
Absolutely. And we're getting better at telling those stories, getting better at finding those stories. Next week I'll be calling athletics for the ABC, and there are 75 track and field athletes, and every one of them has a really interesting journey, ups and downs, sacrifices, dreams. And when you get to know those stories, they become far more personal for you. You're more invested, and it's richer. So it's a big part, I think, of the responsibility of the job that I'm doing.
There is so much emotion with sport, Bruce. I mean, I think it's what gets me in rather than an appreciation or deep understanding of the skills or even, I have to say, the rules when it comes to something like AFL. I'm often a wreck when I'm watching from home. So you, in those charged moments, you know, the Olympic Games, the Melbourne Cup, you've got to keep it together. You've got to keep speaking. You've got to keep thinking. How do you manage that? Is it something you have to do deliberately, or have you got a natural calm that comes upon you at these moments?
It is very different when you're watching. So I still go to events and watch when I'm not calling, and you can, you know, have a tear in your eye when you're watching something that's so moving or somebody wins that you really want to win. And I experience that a lot. And yet when I've got the headphones on, yes, the emotion's still there, but it's controlled, disciplined, I guess. It's the broadcaster that kicks in. I have wondered about that over the years, how that changes, but it just does. You're there to do the job. You're with the team. I love working alongside people, Sarah, you know, whoever they might be, and I've worked alongside so many talented people that have shared that experience with me. And I like, in many ways, being the leader of that team, and that gives me a bit of strength, and it probably keeps me under control a bit. So, it is interesting because there are two very different things for me personally when I'm watching sport. One when I don't have the headphones on, and one when I do.
It's like you're putting on your superhero outfit. It's Batman putting on his suit. You're doing it for the good of the nation then in that moment. I'm curious about how nervous you were. If you've spoken about nerves, what were the nerves like in the lead up to the women's 400 metre final at the Sydney Olympics in 2000?
Kathy's night. That was the fourth day of athletics. So Sydney, I'd been involved with the opening ceremony and been involved in hosting in the first week, called some triathlon. And then, you know, track and field started on the Friday morning, and about 90,000 people in the stadium, you thought, wow. And then on the Monday night, of course, it was the night of the final. And each morning I'd do three or four radio interviews for Channel 7 and promoting what was coming up, Sarah. And that morning, that Monday morning, I knew something was different because I felt like I couldn't put two words together doing these interviews. And it was quite strange. Anyway, the day envelops and goes on, and then I get to the track that night, and it was an incredible night of athletics, nine finals, and a lot of them won by iconic people who I had called before and we all knew pretty well. And Kathy's race was in the heart of the night, so it was probably about the fifth race. And I was going along well, and there had been some fantastic things that had happened. And then when they walked out, the women walked out in their tracksuits for that final, again, I got this really dry mouth. I realised, wow. And I had to say to myself, look, you know what you're doing, just relax, go slowly. And then that was what I said to myself, say, 3 or 4 minutes before the race started. And then they prepared and the gun went and off they went. And I guess at that point you don't think about anything, Sarah. You know, you'd thought about it 3 minutes earlier, and I'd thought about it for 4 years, to be truthful. And then it just happens. And then you just go with the flow, and and hope that it makes a bit of sense.
What was the moment when you realised she was going to do it?
Probably off the backstroke with about 120 metres to go, because I knew that in Atlanta 4 years earlier, she'd made a big move then. And she didn't win there, but she ran her fastest time ever when she ran second to Mary Jo Parekh. And I knew that Kathy would be very strong and she'd be powerful at the end. And so when she was able to get up alongside Fenton and Mary and those runners, Graham was the main one in front at that stage, I felt that she could win from the top of the straight. So it was a celebration in a way, that last 100 metres.
And after she won, you know, there's that famous footage of her collapsing, you know, where it seems like it's relief rather than elation after that enormous pressure that she must have been under in the lead up.
When you think about it, Sarah, her whole career came down to less than a minute. Kathy was a double world champion. She'd won in 1997 and 1999. She'd lost one race in 4 years between the two Olympics, and that was when she was injured in 1998. So she was basically unbeaten. And yet, had she not won in Sydney with all the build-up, with this her biggest chance to win at the Olympic Games, then her whole legacy would have changed. So her career really was 49.11 seconds. She carried a nation on her back that night, because for all of us, we were riding that same journey. So that incredible moment, as you said, when she went to the ground and sat there, and Raylene Boyle, who was sitting alongside, who only Raylene, I think, of Australian athletes could really, in recent times, feel that same pressure, just said, "What a relief," and we all felt it. And then, of course, the celebratory lap and the things that changed afterwards. So it was an incredible moment, incredible night, and in many ways is just as vivid and maybe even more important in 2024 than it was in 2000.
What do you mean?
Well, I think the whole Indigenous situation, reconciliation, Kathy lighting the cauldron, Kathy flying the flag, the two flags, Kathy's inspiration to generations of Australians. I've spoken to so many Australian athletes in so many different sports, and you mentioned the Women's World Cup at the start of the program. When I was able to interview those young women in the lead-up to that event, more than half of them said that Freeman, Kathy, had inspired them in 2000 to be something above the norm. So all those things resonate just as strongly today as they did 24 years ago.
You had a friendship with Kathy, I'm sure, have a friendship with Kathy. You'd called other races, you'd been, you know, at Atlanta and knew her personally. So I imagine the nerves for you, as you said, every Australian felt anxious or on the edge of our seats, and you would have had perhaps a different layer to it as well. What would you have said to her in that post-race interview, Bruce, if she hadn't won? I mean, did you have something prepared?
Not really, Sarah, and not because I didn't think she was a certainty, because there's no such thing. Her chances of winning were probably about 60% on the night, but not really, because I feel in those moments you have to feel it at that very second and respond. We did, Annie and I know and still know Kathy extremely well. And, you know, we did feel, I certainly felt invested in a way that I rarely do. Raylene was similar because she was very close to her. So it was something that I had thought about, but something I decided not to prepare for, because I felt like I'd feel it more than think it.
I just watched again the interview that you do with her, where she's incredibly composed, as she always seemed to be, and natural. She has such a beautiful manner. It's such a lovely interview where your closeness is clear and her respect for you and the kind of jokey, relaxed energy that's between you. But I thought that's something else you've done, Bruce, is not just the event, not just calling the events at the time, but kind of on behalf of the nation, having those interactions with these athletes who mean so much to so many people who don't get the chance to have that conversation. You kind of do it on our behalf, and you just did that with her so beautifully.
It was an incredible night, and what a, you know, privilege I've had, and not just me, so many of us at work in something we enjoy, to engage with people that we respect and want to learn from but have affection for. And so most of my life, I guess, I've been dealing with those types of people, and Kathy is certainly the highlight of my broadcasting career. And that was an amazing night in so many ways. Kathy had won, and then Michael Johnson won, and then the 10,000 metres was on, and that interview took place with about 5 or 6 laps to go in the 10,000 metres, which turned out to be one of the greatest races of all time. So it was just a night that I'll never forget, Sarah, for lots of reasons, mainly because of, you know, Catherine, but for other reasons as well. And it was an incredible experience. I've never had quite a buzz like I did that night, because, you know, throw the headphones off, go and talk to Kathy, throw them back on, finish calling that race. But, you know, going out of the stadium that night, talking to contemporaries from other countries, everyone said that's the best night of track and field, the best night of Olympics they'd ever seen at that stage. And a lot of it was because a national hero had won a gold medal.
The Olympics, the Melbourne Cup, then there's all of the AFL grand finals, the tennis. How do you approach those different events? I mean, do they feel like very different sets of skills that you're using, or is the basic principles the same regardless of the event, of the sport?
I reckon the skills are similar. I mean, you're calling differently. You're certainly calling in athletics and horse racing a little close together when it's like a 1,500-metre race compared with, say, a mile race at the races. But very different when you're calling football. You're calling alongside a bigger team, and there's more punctuation. And when you're doing the tennis, it's not a call as such. It's more a narrative, and you're working alongside people that know a lot more about the game. So they are different, but I go about it in a very similar way, knowing that I'm going to be dealing with a different method and also with different personalities with who I'm working with. So, and I love that variety, Sarah. It's something that I guess has kept me going to the age that I am, that I need that adventure, that variety. If I'd continued to be a race caller, I think I would have probably retired by now. But having all these different, opportunities to meet so many different people and to enjoy so many different sports has been one of the great, I think, gifts that I've been given in my broadcasting career.
Is there any sport, Bruce, that you can't imagine calling or have said no to just because you're not interested in it or you can't get your head around it?
I'd only say no if I didn't think I had the chance to prepare well. Break dancing at these Olympics, I may have a problem with. But I've always felt like, take it on, Sarah. Take it on, as long as you've got a chance to do it justice and do yourself a bit of justice. So, as I said, the more you learn about something, the more interesting it becomes. I read an article about our artistic swimming team in the last sort of 2 weeks about their training regime and how, with some private sponsorship, they've been able to go full-time in the lead-up to the Paris Olympics. Now, artistic swimming was always the one that people say, oh, boy, why is that in the Olympics? But when you read those stories about the strength and the poise and the dedication and what they do outside the pool and how dedicated they are. So I'm using that as an example. I think all sport has its worthiness, and I think it would be disrespectful to turn your back on it.
I'll stop myself from saying even golf, Bruce. I won't even let myself say that. I'll just keep that to myself then.
I do enjoy golf, Sarah.
And the British Open's been on.
We could talk a lot about golf, but anyway, we'll move on.
Let's not. You mentioned the Women's World Cup here in Australia last year and your involvement as part of the commentary team of that. Was soccer a new sport for you to master?
It certainly was. I followed it from afar, like many of us do when it gets to World Cups or Asian Cups, or big events. FA Cup finals, they were huge when we were growing up. The FA Cup finals were about the only thing we saw overseas live at the time. So when I was asked by the Seven Network, would I be involved with the coverage, I jumped at it. The Matildas already had a high profile. You don't get World Cups in Australia every day. It was the first time it had happened. I had a feeling, even months out, that this team would be much, well, they already were much loved, but I felt like it was a little bit like the Sydney Olympics, that we could all go on a journey with this team. And then I had an opportunity in the lead up to the event to get to meet the team and to do some interviews and to get to meet the coach and some key people. And people from the past, the women that have been pioneers that had played the game when there was no real media coverage and no notoriety about it, and they were such an important part of this team, and this team realised that. And I absolutely adored that sort of connection between the now and the past. So I got my head into it, and like everybody else in Australia, was transfixed over the 5 or 6 weeks.
It did feel, as you say, echoes of the Sydney Olympics, and particularly of Cathy Freeman's win, of that unifying joy, really, that sport can bring to a community, to a nation, I think, in that instance. How did the atmosphere at those Matildas games in particular compare with all of the other, you know, sporting matches you've been witness to?
I don't think I've enjoyed anything anymore, I mean, Olympics aside. So I went to about 4 or 5 different stadiums, being part of the team with the Matildas, and each of those stadiums had their own, I guess, they had their own resonance. But the one common denominator was the absolute safety that you felt at the ground, the smiles, the family-orientated crowd, mums and dads with their children, fanatical people, but doing it in a way that wasn't aggressive, wasn't in your face, win, lose or draw. And that's going into the stadium, going down to the ground before and at halftime and after the match, and then walking out of the stadium. It was something I hadn't really felt as much at many other events that I've been to. And I think it was a huge part of the success of that Women's World Cup was the crowds and just the joy and the good sportsmanship and the way that they supported our team and the great players all around the world.
The Olympics is about to begin in Paris, and initially this was not a game that you were going to be involved in commentating on. How did your excellent wife, Annie, play a part in changing that?
It happened so quickly, Sarah, and I have felt lost for a while. And I realise we all get a go, and how many goes, you know, does anyone deserve? So, but I had been involved with the games in one way or another for a long, long time. And for the last 18 months, I've realised that our network didn't have the rights and that I would probably not be involved. So a couple of weeks ago, we'd just come back from watching the US Olympic trials in Eugene, Oregon, and we went over there as a sort of consolation prize in a way just to see that and sit in the stands. And he said to me, Macca, I didn't realise that the ABC have got radio rights to the Olympics. And I said to her, do you know anyone at the ABC? And she said, yeah, I think I do. Anyway, about 5 or 10 minutes later, I was talking to Tim Verrill, whose job it has been to bring this team together. So within about 24 hours, and I was given this opportunity to share the commentary with Quentin Hale and with Melinda Gainsford in track and field. So I had to obviously go to Channel 7, have a chat to Jeff Howard and then to Kerry Stokes, and both of those people were extremely supportive. So
I think it'd be a bold person who'd stand in between Bruce McAvaney and the Olympics, I have to say.
Thank you.
The nation would rise up. There would be a revolt. I don't think they had any option.
I just feel like I've been given this most beautiful birthday present. And I'm very excited about having an opportunity to do it.
And what kind of preparations have you been doing in the lead up? Have you got those index cards out again?
As normal, well, not as normal in a way, Sarah, because I would have started a lot earlier than I have this time. But with athletics, I follow it reasonably closely. So I do write down most elite athletes' results every time they do something. So I've got my books, a lot of books, a lot of cards. I'm doing what I normally do. I'm going to be challenged because I'm going to be doing radio. It'll be a very different thing. But I don't think I've been so optimistic about an Australian track and field team in my broadcasting lifetime. We've got 75 people. We've got a lot of people that are going to do exceptionally well. And the sport itself is going through an absolute revolution in terms of high-end performances. So I picked a good time, I guess, to keep going. And thank you. Thank you to the ABC for giving me this opportunity.
You know, you've really been doing this or a version of this since you were that little kid in your family lounge room with those cardboard horses. Can you even watch sport without commentating on it, Bruce, even if it's just inside your own head?
Not really. not really.
Does that ever come out loud?
Yes. But I honestly...
So you sit in the stands next to Annie and do a blow-by-blow when you were there watching those athletics?
I promised myself I wouldn't do that, and yet within about 5 seconds of off they go in the women's 400-metre hurdles, I can't help myself. But I try to restrain myself. I just can't. The broadcaster, always the broadcaster, I guess, Sarah. So, yeah, I can't really watch without doing a little bit of a Bruce call, so to speak.
As long as you don't do that over, you know, other aspects of your life, if you're not commentating at the supermarket or when you're folding the washing or something.
If you spoke to Annie, she thinks I do. I do have this ability to talk about things that are irrelevant just for the sake of talking, unfortunately. So the true answer to that question is I'd probably commentate on most things in life, Sarah.
Well, we are very lucky to have you commentating with the ABC for the upcoming Olympics. So I hope you have a wonderful event. It's going to be very exciting to watch and to listen to, and it's been such a great pleasure to speak with you on Conversations, Bruce.
Thank you very much.
This conversation was produced by Rebecca McLaren and recorded on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara people. The executive producer of Conversations is Carmel Rooney. I'm Sarah Konoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Konoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.